August 13th at her home in Smithers.
Okay. Your maiden name was Williams?
Yes.
And you were born in Wales?
Yes.
Whereabouts in Wales were you born?
In Cardiff.
Cardiff. Is it, no, refresh my memory. That's south.
That's the capital of
yeah.
Wales.
And it's in the south.
South Wales, right. Yes.
Your father was?
What Thomas. Thomas Williams.
Thomas Williams. And what did he do for, what was his occupation?
We had a farm, dairy farm, and this was what we came out to have a ranch here, as they called it. Mm-hmm. And we had cattle and pigs and horses here.
Why did your father decide to come to Canada? What made him come?
I think he probably wanted a larger larger amount of land. You know, farms in Wales were not very big in those days. Mm-hmm. And he always wished that he had more land and wasn't possible to acquire anymore. So then he begin to hear about these marvelous places in Canada where you got 125 acres in a quarter section. That, of course, we didn't realize that half of it would be fit for farming anyway. But it was quite an adventure. So we came.
Was this part of a group of people? Did you come
no,
with other people?
No,
or you came?
No, just as a family.
Mm-hmm. And when you arrived in the Bulkley Valley. How did you come here? Did you come by train or?
Yes, we came across, we came on the Empress of France to Quebec,
mm-hmm.
Quebec City. And then we got on the train and came right to Smithers, where this ranch was waiting for us. It was June the 1st, 1928, and just a beautiful morning, except that they'd had a heavy frost, and when we came through Talca, the Talca station was there, of course, then, and we were amazed that the roof was frosted open, and Mother said, my word, they have snow here.
In June.
Yes, June the 1st. But, of course, that was about 5:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
But it was exciting, really, for my sister and I. My brothers were younger. One brother was 8 and the other brother was a year and a half.
So you came out from Ontario by train?
From Quebec.
Oh, from Quebec by
yes,
train.
Yes, we changed at Winnipeg.
How long did that trip take you?
Well, we left on May 19th from mm-hmm. Britain, and I think it must have been about 7 days that we would have been, 7 or 8 days. And then we arrived here on June the 1st, so that would be 6 or 7 days.
Yeah, maybe. That's quite a long trip.
It was, yeah. Yes.
I bet you were glad to arrive, finally, in the Bulkley Valley.
Well, I'm sure my mother and father were,
mm-hmm.
but it's such an experience for us, and I remember getting out on the little stations in Quebec, you know. This surprised us that everyone got out of the train and walked around, because in Britain, you know, no train waits for you to get out, much less walk around. And the lovely little churches, and oh, it was just
so
beautiful.
When you arrived in the Bulkley Valley, you stayed at a farm in Driftwood, is that?
We stayed in a log cabin up there, still on the McCabe Road.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And was this a friend's?
No, it was just empty. And just an empty log cabin that, because they had told us, we stayed in the Bartley Hotel for a few days, a week or so. And then when there was a man from the Soldier Settlement Board here to meet my father, although he wasn't here the morning we arrived, and we were a little at a loss, so we checked him over now. But my father thought that they had said the house, there would be a house and buildings on the ranch, but of course there wasn't. They also had said there was a creek running through the ranch, which there wasn't.
So it was a bit of a surprise. But
yes, it was. On top of that, coming across the country, some of the train men would come in. Some of the cars, at the end, they have a little kind of place with a few seats, they used to in those days, and we more or less took over one of these, so it was more or less to ourselves. And the train men would come along and chat all along the line and ask us about, they'd usually take my youngest brother on his knee. Some of them, they were very friendly, and one of them had said, they asked my father where we were going, and they said, oh, Smithers, oh yes, they knew. This was back in Ontario. But as we get closer this way, they said, good heavens, why would they ever send people who were going to farm up there? Not very much. So, you know, that wasn't very good news for someone that's coming to a new country. My father was a quiet person. He, didn't really do a lot of talking about that. And I think it must have, I'm sure the mother's heart sank a few times. But anyway, we were here.
When you came to Smithers, you worked for a bit.
Yes. We discovered there was nothing to do out in the country. We were settled in this little log cabin, and my father was going down to work on the house along with the crew down further on during the days. And of course, we didn't have any animals or anything at this point. And we'd visited all the people around came to visit us and make us welcome. They were just marvelous. Mm-hmm. And then there were a very nice couple that lived at the top of the road where a school teacher boarded with them. So, and they became very good friends of ours, all of them. But still, I said to my mother, we used to come into Smithers, and my sister and I sometimes would walk in. I was fascinated by all these homes and the log houses, and I wondered how people lived. And I don't mean that they were lovely, but what life would be like in a log house, that's the way I should put it. And I think it would be marvelous just to be able to live with a family and find out how the Canadians lived. And then then one day when we were on walking up Main Street, a little Scottish person came up to us and asked us if we'd like to work in a restaurant. So we immediately thought of little aprons, you know.
And so, a little caps.
Yes, like they do in some of the restaurants that they had opened. And we said we would have to go home and talk to our parents. And that evening, they arrived out to talk to my parents because this man was going to open the dining room, which had been closed in the Smithers Hotel. Mm-hmm. And they assured my father and mother that they would take care of us, that we would have a room in their hotel, you see, and they would keep an eye on us. Life was exciting in that hotel, I can tell you.
I can imagine.
And the cook was, they told us that he was 90 years old. He had a gray beard and a tall black hat and straight, nice-looking man. And he never told us, but he said, people told us afterwards that he'd lost his wife and children in the San Francisco earthquake.
Oh.
And then had taken to prospecting in the hills. And there were all kinds of prospectors in the hills around. And of course, the Duthie Mine was operating at that time.
And what was this cook's name? Do you remember?
Hunt. Mm-hmm. Sam Hunt. Hmm. And but we... unfortunately, he had been cooking in logging camps and mining camps and decided he wanted to come into town, and possibly the Mackenzies at the hotel may have talked him into it. But he, of course, was giving far too large meals to people that he wasn't making it pay, and at the end of 6 weeks, he decided that it really wasn't for him. Mm. I do recall when he told us he filled a box with spices and that he had in the restaurant and got a taxi and I think that he, if I remember rightly, he came out with us to when we went out to the back to the ranch and to talk to mother and father, and explain why he had decided to give up the restaurant. I'm quite sure my sister and I weren't very much help. We did our work, but we didn't have any experience, you know, and an experienced waitress could have said to him, you're giving too much, or you food, or this kind
you're
of thing.
You're not charging enough.
Yes, yeah. I think so. But he was very nice. He was just a gentleman.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other customers that you remember particularly?
One night he had occasion to get annoyed, and I was amazed. I hadn't seen any signs of temper. He was so very nice to work with. But it was one day, and four men had come in, and they'd obviously been drinking, and sat off in a booth. And I went and waited on them. And he was in the kitchen. He said, if you have any problems, you know, just come and tell me. But they were quite well behaved, except that, you know, they pushed their food around and so on. And then one of them got up and sauntered out, and I was at the cash register near the door, and sauntered by. When they got to the door, he said, one of the other fellows was going to pay for my dinner, so off he went, and then the next one later on did that. So there was one little French-Canadian man that was a tiny little man, left, and he really had had a lot to drink, but he finally ambled up and said something to me, and I said, just a minute, I think, can't think of his name, but I think I knew it then anyway. I said, just a minute, those other men said that you were going to pay for the dinner. Oh, he opened his eyes very wide and he said, I ain't got no money, only in a French accent, you know. And I said, well, just a minute. So I went out to, he waited, and I went out and got Mr. Hunt. I said, you go back and sit down, and then Mr. Hunt will come and talk to you. So I went and called Mr. Hunt from the kitchen, and he... he came in. I said, this man says he has no money, and the others all said that he would pay. So he came in and he picked up this poor little man by the tie. He had a shirt and tie, I remember, a very thin little neck, you know, and he jerked him up out of the seat and threw him back across the table, which I'd taken all the dishes out, and started to say, you pay that girl what she has told you owe. And he said, Sam, I ain't got no money. Ain't got no money, Sam. And I recall this one fellow that worked for the forestry. He was a Scottish fellow, young. And he, I think, was in the next booth. And he came out, and I always remember that I was absolutely terrified. I'd never seen anything like this. I thought, he's going to kill him, and this is what they'd say about the Wild West, you know, they kill people so easily. And this fellow looked at what was going on, and he said, for God's sake, Sam, you're going to frighten the girl to death. He was more concerned about me, and I was concerned
right.
About this man. Oh, yes, those were fun days. Of course, Mother and Father never heard any of this because we would have been taken home. Mm-hmm. And life was really quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other types of jobs that young girls would have had besides working
in the restaurant? Well, yes, there were one or two stores that employed, one girl. Mm-hmm. And I think I had gone around all those to see if there were any jobs, but there wasn't anything. Of course, there were more girls here than there were places to mm-hmm. work. But... during the time I was in the restaurant, this Mr. Carr had come in and suggested that his wife would like to have someone to help with the children if I ever was interested. And so I remembered that, and I remarked to Mother that I thought I would like to go and see this person. And Mother said, looked concerned, and she said, I really don't know what help you're going to be with children. She didn't. Well, my sister loved to cook. Every time, you know, she had the house to herself, she would cook something. But I was not a bit interested in cooking. But we had a marvelous few months before I went to work in the post office, and the cars were just. I couldn't have chosen a nicer family to. And they were so understanding of a person that was new mm-hmm. to. Canadian ways, and Mrs. Carr was, she had come out from Ottawa and married Mr. Carr when they had been on a ranch out in the valley mm-hmm. before they had moved into town some years later. And she said that then that she had been here 15 years. And I was just amazed, you know, that someone had lived here 15 years. And look at me now, 62 or something.
What sort of traditions that the Carr family had were different for you? Like, you mentioned that there were some different things that they used to do.
The Christmas was different to the Christmas that, and later on the Christmas day, you see, I had gone out. We had been taken out, my sister and I, to have Christmas with mother and dad. But yes, I can't recall. You know, one gets so used to life. But they were very they explained things that, well, you know, English people have sayings that are not acceptable in Canada. I mean, they mean totally different things. And if I made some remark, and Katie, her name was Katie Carr, she would always say, "Now, you know, that means something else." So she would explain that, and I would know when to use it again. Hmm. But they were, she, when we would go out and meet people, and then she, they always, and I used to go to the Anglican Church, my sister and I, and of course we became involved in their activities and so on, and I would be interested to know about these people that I had met, perhaps, and she would always, you know, explain who they were and how long they'd been here. Little place. Mm-hmm. Of course, you knew everything about everyone.
Well, that's right.
So I was very fortunate. And then when I went to work in the post office, I still boarded with them. Mm-hmm. So it was like home, really.
What sort of things did you do in the post office? Were you at the wicket, or?
Yes, okay. Yes. Okay. Sorted the mail and did all kinds of things. Sometimes when the postmaster was on holidays, I ran the post office. There was enough work for two, but not a great deal. You're on your way.
Yeah, I got around. Thanks.
Well, put in the game before you leave.
Actually.
So I didn't cross that there when one gets to. I always remember the postmaster saying to me, "Don't be surprised if you get some." You've got that on, I guess, and I can't think of the word. Proposals.
Oh,
some proposals from some of the old ranches. I was amazed, you know. I laughed and said, "Oh, I'm sure." But sure enough,
where was the post office in the old Mason Adams?
Yes, it was down where there's a radio. I think the
radio shack.
Shack. That's right. That's where the post office was in there. Although I think Central Clothing has done a little. Changing around, but it was a fairly good-sized place, really. Yeah. And of course, there wasn't much of a hallway, and there were boxes all the way around, as in the post office.
So people would come in and pick up their mail.
Yes. Well, the mail came by train, mm-hmm. and the place would be just like a hive of bees. Everyone waiting for you to sort the mail, and every time they heard something go in their box, they would open it up. And some of the conversations one heard while he was sorting letters that were going on in these little cubby holes.
Oh, I bet.
It was very interesting, quite an education, I can tell you. But I enjoyed that too, really. Things are very different in the post office now, of course. Mm-hmm. You knew everyone, and I, well, goodness, I went to work, I think, at 8:30. And I got home at 6 for supper, and I went back again at 7 or 7:30 to tie up the mail, and it had to be tied up in little bundles for each town or village.
Oh, I see.
And then any of the small places, it would go by train. They had mailmen on the train, and they would be resorting the sacks of mail. And then when it got to the village, say Talqua, the bundle would be thrown out, mm-hmm. or sack. They would have it in a sack along with other mail.
So while you were working at the post office, you were single at this point?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
you got married in 1934?
Yes, although I had left the post office then. I had been down in Duncan for a year with my...
Oh.
husband's, my fiance's parents. Mm-hmm. And then when I came home, I was at home on the ranch for a few months, and we were married. 1934.
Did you get married in Smithers?
Yes.
At the Anglican Church?
On a Sunday morning at 8 o'clock.
Oh, my goodness. And the reason you had to get married in the morning, was there a reason for that? I mean, most people didn't stay in Smithers for their honeymoons, as I recall.
No. Well, we went to Prince George, and my husband decided I should. I think I had been to Prince George once before I was married, but I had never been to Cornell. Mm-hmm. Snow on the ground, and I remember the roads were terrible. From Prince George to Cornell was a famous road. It was all originally planks and
trees.
It was
like a corduroy road.
Yeah, yes. Mm-hmm. Went one and came back two. The country was in some ways more exciting than it is now, because mm-hmm. it was so new and everyone was pioneering, mm-hmm. and no one complained really. The general conversation surprised me. The way everyone talked about the roads and how good they were, and if we could just get a road into here, and I thought, my goodness, these people are obsessed with roads and politics too. Mm-hmm. Everywhere, you know, politics entered into it, this was something, of course, we'd taken for granted in England, and my father was not involved in politics, so we never heard much about it. We voted when my father and mother did, mm-hmm. when the time came. I often wish that we had even come sooner, and that I'd had an opportunity of going to school here. But mm-hmm. I had finished school, of course, when I came out here, mm-hmm. and I thought that too was different, yeah. the way they taught school, because some of the children were going to school and they would come home and tell me. The children were fascinated, of course, with the way they would bring all their friends to have me just say hello and a few words, and then they would go into fits of laughter and to think I spoke very...
Well, you spoke English, but just with an accent.
Yes, right. Yes. And then some of the things I recall, when someone, they left, I would say cheerio, and then they would all go into fits. I thought that was terribly funny.
After you got married in 1934, did you keep working, or...?
No. Oh, good gracious, no. I there weren't jobs, and women... I don't recall any women working, unless it might have been in their husband's business or mm-hmm. something like that.
And your husband worked...?
My husband was a mechanic with Henry Motors, mm-hmm. That was up the street here. Mm-hmm. Towards Main Street, but then he opened and started his own business down across there. He built a service station across from the Fincher building where you work.
Oh, really?
Yes, on that, okay. Where the park is, mm-hmm. across the road there, on mm-hmm. that corner, that was where the service station, and then he enlarged it over the years and put in.
So he used to work with Mr. Henry.
Yes.
And then he went later on. When was that? Was that?
Well, that must have been in 32 or 3. I do have a clipping here somewhere where it mentions that a new garage had opened its doors. Mm. But in those days, no one had a great big opening or anything like that. You just quietly, and people had been waiting to go to him. I think that Henry Motors had closed down. They were having financial problems, as many people were, because mm-hmm. they were depression years, and so you did everything very conservatively.
That's right.
And when my husband went to talk to the banker about borrowing some money to put up this building, the banker, who was an old friend and a very dear person, and he had a little nervous problem that his head
shook back and forth.
Yes.
Yeah.
And of course, everyone said that that's why people were afraid to ask him for a loan, because they always thought he was saying no.
But in fact, he wasn't. He was just
But he
twitching.
Looked at my husband. He said, Oswald, people are closing businesses. They're not starting them. And my husband said, well, I'm going to start somehow, and I'm going to get the money. He had some, you mm-hmm. see, but he said, I think that I can make. And I suppose he, you know, looking back on it, I don't remember. I know we didn't have enough money to get married anyway, so that was impossible. But I do recall that will give you some idea of the economy, that when we were married, which was probably a couple of years later, we moved into a little house that we were able to rent for $13 a month.
Now, in those days, that would have been a fair amount of money, would it not?
I suppose so, yes. Mm-hmm. I know that we had, there were more houses for rent, of course, than there are now. And anyone that built their own house, they didn't have these,
apartment?
No, they didn't have apartments. But the way people can build a house now and get money from...
Like mortgages?
Yes, but there is, I can't recall the name of the association, that they have to be built to certain standards before you can get the money. But there was nothing like that then. You just had to, have the money to build a house. And people built, there were tiny little houses, tiny little log houses. And I do recall a little log house that was down near where the Super Value is now. Mm-hmm. And it was the tiniest little place, and there was a Canadian couple that lived in it, and he worked on the railroad, and I don't remember his name, but she dressed so beautifully, and that house was like a doll's house inside. And this surprised me, that people with such tiny places, and they were so artistic, and their places, their houses and homes were delightful. There weren't many large houses. This house had been built in 1917, mm-hmm. and my father-in-law had been moved up from Hazleton. They were moving the provincial buildings and government offices up here, and he had come up, and this house was for sale, and he had bought it. And once when my sister and I were used to walk around and admire some of the houses, and we had been going by this house, and this dining room window, the blind was up. It was an evening, and we peeked. I did. My sister, who was younger, she said, "Come quickly, someone will see you peeking." But I could see this boy sat in here doing his homework, you know, a young boy, and an older man sat at the table there, and I thought, and of course we were very homesick.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents were very homesick too. It's only natural.
Even when you come from so far away.
Yes, yeah. You're bound to long for the things. When I recall when I was helping mother get and dad get settled in the, and my sister and I were opening up one of the chests, and mother had a great big table, heavy plush tablecloth was the kind of thing they had on. Dining room table, and we had put this on this table in this log cabin, and the tears just rolled down mother's face. You know, all these things were just so that it was very interesting.
So you looked through the window and you saw this boy sitting in this house, and you didn't know Mr. Hoskins?
No, we didn't know. My sister had remarked to me that she thought an English family lived here, people perhaps from England, because all the flowers in the garden, they had a beautiful garden, and they were all flowers that we had
mm-hmm.
seen in Wales and England. But no, I never dreamed I would spend my life in this house.
Isn't it fate?
It is strange, yeah. Isn't it, how things... No. No, we didn't even know the name of the people in those days that were here. But
When you first saw downtown Smithers, what was your first impression? Were you...
Well, it was a beautiful morning, mm-hmm. and the wooden sidewalks, of course, were clean. And then they had this, they called it a ditch, but it was quite wide, where in the spring the water flowed freely. But I don't recall noticing the water. I thought the buildings were interesting, because they were all wooden buildings, and we had been used to stone and brick and mm-hmm. this kind of thing. And it was fascinating to look, and I recall someone, probably my sister, we walked that morning down the main street, and we looked, there was a store there where the travel agency are now, next to the, that was a store, and they had ladies' wear and some bathing suits, and someone said, oh, there must be somewhere to swim, there must be a lake or something, because they have bathing suits
right.
in the window. Yeah, so lots of different.
Are there any of the stores that you remember still in town, or have they all changed?
This store, Home Hardware, mm-hmm. That I remember when that first was EB's Hardware,
okay.
and that was fairly. I think that had just been built when we were here.
What did the inside of EB's Hardware look like? Was it filled with all kinds of...
I don't recall. Mm. I think my father probably was in there getting, tools and things that he would need. I really don't remember much about the interior. I do recall that down where Bearder's Dry Goods is, they had...
To the Dunlop store.
One day I went in there to buy a reel of cotton, and there was a person in there, and Mrs. Dunlop was very friendly, and they, of course, everyone wanted to know where we were from and mm-hmm. where we were living and so on. But this person I hadn't met before, and she was a cousin that used to come out and spend holidays with them from Eastern Canada. And so I said I wanted a reel of white cotton. So I realized she didn't know what I meant, and she picked up a bolt of white cloth and said, some of this? And I said, no, a reel of cotton. So she was so puzzled, and it didn't dawn on me then that she didn't understand what I meant. And I think she said, what are you going to do? And I said, oh, I want to mend something. And she said, oh, you mean a spool of thread.
A reel of cotton.
Oh, yes, Miss McLaughlin, her name was. Oh, yes. Things like that puzzled, and we wouldn't know the difference.
Mm-hmm.
I could tell you more about the interior of the ladies' wear store, I think, the hardware.
Well, it seems to me, either I was speaking with you or someone else, and there used to be benches outside.
Yes, there did, yes.
Was that all the stores, or just EB's?
No,
or?
There were just, EB's Hardware, you see a lot of the prospectors would go there. They would have things that, the supplies that... they would need to take on these prospecting trips, and so they would come in to hike into town, and they would sit out there on a bright summer morning and
watch
have
all
a
the
chat
yeah,
with
and
all
watch
the
all
other.
The girls go by.
Yes, all those things, and of course the clothing they wore was so different.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that we were disappointed in, that the natives didn't have long braids and cloaks and blanket capes,
mm-hmm.
What
was your first impression of the natives?
Well, we didn't think much about it. In Britain, I don't recall that we had ever seen an Indian. We'd certainly read about them. And somehow, over there, you never really thought very much about what race a person was. They were people.
Mm-hmm.
And this surprised me rather, that out here people were so anxious to know what we were. Someone would say, well, I'm Scottish or I'm Irish. And I used to think, well, so what? We had Scottish and Irish people there. You know, we couldn't understand why all this stress on. Mm-hmm. Now I understand it more. So that the Indians, we realized, were people who had always lived here, and they were rather shy and timid. I think possibly we spoke to them. I recall in the post office, some of the native women used to come in and have me write their love letters for them and tell me what to say, and because they weren't able to write. And but we found this, we took that for granted, rather, that there were so many different kinds of people. And I don't recall that there were any, the Indians, some are pale and some are dark, but I do remember, certainly we weren't frightened of them or anything like that.
Did the natives shop in the same stores that everybody else did?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. And they worked, some of the native women worked in people's homes, mm-hmm. to help. Them, you know, usually they would go in for a day or so, a week, and clean and that kind of thing.
Right.
And I think on the ranches they often would have a tent up and help with the farm work and that kind of thing, and always had been. Because I remember Mrs. Carr telling me that when they were out on the ranch, that they had natives that had a place down near the creek that they used to come and work for them.
So if something was happening on the farm, like if they were haying or something, they would have some natives come in to give them a hand.
Yes, and I think that has gone on up until the last 10 or 12 years, actually. Mm. Perhaps some of the farmers still have natives do that. I really don't know. Mm-hmm. Now everything is so mechanized.
Well, that's
they don't need so many hands, do they?
No.
But of course, in those days, no farms had electricity, and it was strictly coal oil lamps and this kind of thing.
A lot of manual labor.
Well, the electricity in the town was very. On Mondays, it came. I think the village bought it from the CNR, and on Monday mornings, from 9 until 12, they put on extra power so that people could run these washing machines. That was something I had never seen until I came here. And you can imagine that no one had electric stoves or electric kettles or toasters or anything like that. It was all.
But you had your washing machine that you could use on Mondays.
Yes.
Monday mornings.
Yes.
What other electrical appliances would you have in the home?
I don't remember whether they had vacuum cleaners, and certainly no floor waxers.
You get down on your hands and knees.
Well, I think people used to put, I don't remember that I waxed floors, but I know that I've heard of people putting a brick in a blanket and pushing it around, you know, mm-hmm. to get a good polish. Of course, they used hard wax and that kind of thing. No, we take so much for granted,
I know. Do you remember, what do you remember as being the main livelihood of most of the people that were in Smithers when you arrived?
Oh, there seemed to be a little bit of everything. A lot of people worked for the railway.
Yeah.
And they are at the station, they had offices, dispatchers, and then there was a roundhouse where the engines were serviced and all that kind of thing. So that employed quite a lot of people, and Smithers was a divisional point, which I think was probably the main source of income,
mm-hmm.
at that time. And then, of course, there were farmers and mining. The Duthie Mine people,
mm-hmm.
used to come down and shop in Smithers, and so it suffered when there was a depression, as most places do. But on the whole, I think most people thought they had a good life. A lot of houses were partly built because people couldn't afford to finish them right then, but they would get a certain amount up. And there used to be a place Maybe someone else has mentioned this to you. A funny old building, and I think it was on this street further down, but may have been on the next street. And people spoke of the hellish mess. Oh, you know, the hellish mess, down at the hellish mess. And so finally I asked someone, what about the hellish mess? What was it? And they laughed and said it was it had been a boarding house at one time, and then I think the people had retired and left. And so a group of men had, like the bank boys and school teachers and things like that, had moved into this place, and I guess they had a manager there. In fact, I think there was a man that worked in Watson's store, and I think his name was Finity, and it seems to me that he more or less ran the place. Mm-hmm. And I suppose you can imagine a few bachelors that this is why it was called the Hellish Mess.
Yes, actually we have a picture of the inside of Watson's store with Mr. Finity in the picture.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Oh, yes. Come down and take a look.
Yes.
So I guess you've noticed a significant change in the livelihood of people in Smitherhoods. I mean, if most of the people were working for the railway, certainly now the economy is a little more diversified. We have people working for the railway, then the government.
And the mill and so on. Yes. Yes, of course, there weren't many more people working for the government than there were in those days. I remember that the government agent had a secretary, a girl that worked there, and then there was a mining recorder and a tax assessor, and can't recall, there must have been, yes, there were other things, and I can't think of the name of them, but they may have had help, girl clerks working for them, but nothing like they have now.
No.
And but they were depression years for many years.
Were there any things that you were not able to get during the Depression, like things that we take for granted now that maybe weren't so easily?
I suppose there were, but I think possibly I don't really recall. I think that there was everything available that people were used to having.
Mm-hmm.
And even during later on during the war, they, of course, the First World War had transpired before we came. The Second World War wasn't until 1939. I recall at that point that we had ration books, I think, for sugar and liquor, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were very fortunate here. And a lot of things that people might have expected coming in from outside that people wouldn't have had here anyway. But let's see. No, I recall my mother thought that the stores were very well, the grocery stores were very well stocked with things, and many things that perhaps she hadn't found so available in Britain and in Wales, because of course we had been through a war there when we'd had ration books, and I recall that in Wales, when butter and sugar and cheese or all kind of meat, all those things were rationed over there.
So we were pretty fortunate.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. I think so. And I don't think that people, I think people had a struggle because they were depression years, and certainly people are affluent today in comparison.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think anyone ever really starved, because people were so kind, and out in the country they always traded what they had, you know, with other things that you might have.
So it was more of a barter system than a...
I think a lot of that, and wood. Of course, everyone burned wood in those early days.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the farmers that had stands of timber on their land, were able to sell that, and they brought it into town and poultry. And we had a very good doctor and a hospital. And
who was the doctor?
Dr. Hankinson was here,
yes.
And he lived in the house across the street.
Well, he lived in Mrs. Kilpatrick's house.
Yes. And he was a very, very wonderful person. I recall one. Do you want to hear a little anecdote?
Yes, I'd love
that happened
to.
When I was in the post office, and I was making up the mail one night, and he often came in late with things, and I heard his voice saying, "I have some mail here," and he dropped it into the box. So I went and got it out, and one was a big brown envelope, and that had to be cancelled. The stamp had to be cancelled. You see, on that with a hammer, that you. And so I cancelled the stamp and hurried to get it because we had to get it done at a certain time.
Mm-hmm.
It dropped it into the mail bag, and somehow as I dropped it in, I thought, that didn't sound quite right. And I fished in, practically went into the mail bag myself, trying to get down to the bottom. And fished this out, and something was leaking in this envelope. And I thought, oh my goodness, it's probably something from the hospital that's been, and it, I think it, the ad, I looked at the address and it was going to Edmonton to a lab. And I thought, oh, what will I do? So I immediately locked the post office up and grabbed this thing.
This leaking package.
Oh, yes, and went over. By this time, I think I got hold of my husband, who was, you know, just a friend then. But I first of all ran over here to his house, and Mrs. Hankinson said, "Oh, Ruby, I know that's something very important. You'd better find him. Go and try the hospital." And the hospital in those days was over
King?
Yes.
Yeah.
And near the where the school is, only up New Hampshire School was up further this way. And so I rushed into the hospital, and one of the nurses went and got him, and Dr. Hanson came down. Now, he was a very nice person. He had glasses, and he used to be always very pleasant in the post office, but I was always a little intimidated by him. I had grown up in a very strict society in where you listened to what men had to say.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just shaking at this point. But I told him what had happened. I said, you know, I cancelled the stamp and I think I'd broken. And he never said anything to me, but he was standing in the doorway, and it was an old frame building. And I always remember he raised his fist and brought it down against the door frame, and the building shook, and so did I. I was just so he took it anyway. Never blamed me or anything. He took the thing off and opened it, and he said, "You just cracked the bottle of fluid it was in," and he said, "Everything's fine." So he wrapped it up again, and I rushed back and got it into the mail sack. But I never forget that. And someone said, "Why did you let on?" I said, "Oh, I realized it was far too serious
mm-hmm.
a thing to
ignore,
to pretend I didn't know about it, and to think that I almost missed it
mm-hmm.
by you know, just thinking that had a strange sound." But that was only one of these things that, you know, happened to post office, but that particular one was the most serious, I think. Occasionally I would get someone and come in and say, "You put my letter in someone else's box." And I would
shrug and say,
"No,
I did."
No, sometimes I would. Sometimes I can recall one occasion when sometimes, you know, I sorted the mail, the letters was in the morning. You kind of stand and flip them around, and they would land in the next one. But most people were understanding as long as they got their letter. I think there was one one person said that I'd done it purposely. I was trying to send her mail to someone else.
Well, there certainly were some interesting people in the early days of Smithers.
Oh, there really were.
You mentioned to me that you knew Wiggs O'Neill.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, what sort of person was he?
Oh, he was a fascinating, fascinating person, and lots of stories to tell. Oh, you would have enjoyed talking to Wiggs. He was so amusing, and he just full of beans. He ran apart from the garage, and he had a partner in the garage, a Chevrolet garage, but he had a theater. And I forget how many nights a week. At first he showed them in the old town hall, which was where the post office is now.
Mm-hmm.
But then I don't recall whether I don't think that he built a theater. I think it must have been later that some people built a theater. But Wiggs, I know it was well patronized, because of course there wasn't another one, and it wasn't every night. It was two, three nights, I think, a week.
And how much was it to go to the movies?
Oh, heavens, I don't know, probably 25 cents.
Yeah.
I really don't remember that, but he used to tell me later on, after I was married and I knew him, he would tell me stories about the old days, and when he was telling me one story, which illustrates the kind of person he was, full of fun. And he had been having a little feud when he lived in Hazleton, and he was very eligible battle. And some young school teacher, I think, was having a party, and a skating party out at Seely Lake. And it was a big, grand affair. They really used to go to such a great deal of trouble. And he said that she and the current boyfriend were in a kind of bower on this part of the lake. And everyone went. And he said he was the only one in the group of young people in Hazleton that had been ignored. And of course he never was. He was always practically the first on everyone's list. And he said, he laughed and he said, I knew why she did that, but I thought, now she can't get away with that. So he said, I just got dressed up. And they did get dressed up, even though they were going to skate in those days. And he said, I went along after everyone had arrived, and he said they were sat in this bower. And he said, I went over and I said, and gave her name, and he said, I knew that it was an oversight, that intend to leave me out, and here I am, and you're having a lovely party. And I thought, that's, he just was so much fun, and I'm sure she probably was delighted that he had come, because he was good company, would
mm-hmm.
make a party go.
Would make it very exciting anyway.
Yes.
Another person you mentioned to me was Mr. Kirby. What can you tell me about Mr. Kirby?
Well, a lot of things, really. He was a rather forbidding, in a way,
mm-hmm.
person when you first met him. And then when you got to know him and chatted with him, he was really a very nice old gentleman.
He worked with the police, did he?
He did in Hazleton, apparently, mm-hmm. but before I knew him. But up here, he was a mining recorder,
mm-hmm.
and he was, he had, my husband knew him really from when he was a small boy, and Mr. Kirby had a son that was about my husband's age, and they had been friends in Hazleton, and then when they moved up here, I think that Ernest, the boy, I think he drowned in Seymour Lake when he was about 16 or 17
mm.
one summer. And my husband used to keep an eye, chat with, and that, of course, as he became older and needed help and so on. But he was very interesting, and goodness gracious, the stories that he He could tell. He was just an amazing person.
You mentioned to me that you have some of his photographs.
Yes, I have some pictures. I can't exactly recall what they were. They probably were. He had been a policeman at Port Simpson out on the coast, and I think there's some pictures there. And I've often thought that they should be in the museum, and I'll probably dig them out and bring them down.
Okay.
Because I think one time I had talked to someone that was there, and they said that they had so many pictures at that time and probably hadn't got them organized.
Well, they're all organized now, and we're always very happy to have. What we often do is borrow pictures from people, make a copy, and keep the negative, and then return your photograph to you.
Yes.
So you don't give up a photograph. You simply loan it to us, and then we're able to.
Well, I think that these would be better off in the museum because I'm sure that what will happen to them when I'm not around. People don't hang on to all these things. It's just that I happen to have a big house with lots of cubby holes.
Lots of place to put it.
Yes, which isn't a good idea.
Yeah.
Really. It's far better to have a small space that you don't hoard.
You had also told me that you had done a lot of volunteer work. You'd worked for the hospital auxiliary, for example.
Oh, yes. We all worked for, did volunteer work in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Do
you remember when the auxiliary started? And
no, it was certainly before I came to Smithers, because I recall that Mrs. Carr belonged to the hospital auxiliary.
Mm-hmm.
She had been in a bit of a fuss one day, I recall, getting ready for some occasion, and I had said, "Why do you bother?" Because she had a lot to do. And she said, "Oh, well, we all have to work for these things, and you find out when you're married that everybody has to do their bit," which was quite true.
What sort of things did the hospital auxiliary do that you participated in?
Oh, they, we had hospital day, tag day, and raise money mostly to buy equipment. And The Sisters of St. Anne were running the hospital when I joined the auxiliary, and they were marvelous people. They did an awful lot of things that nowadays volunteers have to do. I recall having a bazaar a few years, although that was, everyone had a date in the town. You didn't ever put on, one organization wouldn't dream of putting something on when it was the Catholic churches or the Anglican church's date and this kind of thing. So you kept, and I do recall before I belonged to the auxiliary that they used to have Charles Fancy Dress.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was probably around Halloween or something.
I've seen photographs of children
dressed
up for this day, and they'd have contests and things.
Yes, a lot of things like that. And then they had, I think they gave that up because, gradually these things are marvelous for a while, and then people get a little tired and the interest goes somewhere else, so they discontinued that and carried on with other things.
Did they continue with that over the war? Was that a continuation?
I don't recall what happened during the war. I think most of us, I know we had belonged to bridge. People played a great deal of bridge here, mixed and ladies and this kind of thing, and often had bridge parties to raise money.
Mm-hmm.
Had public bridge parties to raise money. But during the war, suddenly, everyone, you belonged to the Red Cross and worked for that, or you took, I remember going and taking first aid courses and all this kind of thing, because the interest and the attention was on other more necessary
things.
Yeah.
You had also mentioned that you had worked for a time with the Tourist Information Center.
Oh, yes.
When did you start doing that?
Well, I was the first first one. I really knew all the places by that time that, mm-hmm. that would be interesting to tourists, and
so
I
this
enjoyed
is,
it.
This is in the late 60s?
No, it would be possibly... it would possibly be the beginning of the 60s,
okay.
I would think. Mm-hmm. And it might even have been before that. The radio station had they were in a house down at the end of town, and one, they had a spare room, which I guess had been a bedroom, and so the information booth was in there, and people came in and signed the book, you know, and asked about what was available in the area, and we had maps, and gradually, we really, none of us quite knew what we were doing, and now the Tourist Bureau is, in most places, is well equipped.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't so in those days, and not every small town had an information.
And this was a volunteer thing, was it?
No.
Was a paid position. Oh.
No, it was, I think the Chamber of Commerce were the people who were organizing it,
mm-hmm.
and thought we should have one. Now, I don't know whether they were contributing to the salary. I think we were paid, I recall, seems to me a dollar, wouldn't it? Would it have been a dollar a day or a dollar an hour?
Oh my goodness!
The first, yes, the money certainly didn't attract one. I guess I always enjoyed doing things that where I, you know, would know people, and it seemed like. It seemed very exciting to me, who was a housewife.
Well, what sort of things would you do with the tourist information? Sit and answer questions, or
yes, and they would know, how do you get to Glacier Gulch? Can you find us a motel with a swimming pool? I recall that was one thing. And people would come in late and want to know if there was anything available in the area, and I had a list of hotels, and I could phone them and find out if they could put up a group of four, or if they had rooms for this, because we didn't have a great deal of accommodation at first.
Mm-hmm.
Here, so hotels have been built since. We supplied them. We had local maps for them to get to the fossil beds and to the Glacier Gulch and. Up to, I'm not sure, I guess up to the ski hill, that they could drive up there even in the summertime, and places like Talca and what was available, fishing, where the fishing was, and how to get out to Babbin Lake. And
so really, the job of the tourist information person hasn't changed very much.
No, it hasn't, except I think that they have many more pamphlets to offer people,
mm-hmm.
and they've become much more sophisticated, I would say, than we were. But it was enjoyable, and people that came in, and it was, I do recall one man from, but this must have been later in the 60s, because this man came in one night, and it was getting late, and he said, we would like to go on to Hazleton. And because we have a camper, and we were thinking of camping at Seeley Lake. And I said, he said, there is a place like that. And I said, oh yes, very nice campsite there. And he said, tell me now, would we be safe at Seeley Lake? And I said, oh, of course you would. And he said, you mean the Indians wouldn't bother us? And I said, oh, you'd be a lot safer at Seeley Lake than you would in camping in Southern California. Which he was from, and he said, oh, I grant you that. I said, well, I go down there with my husband, and I said, there are many places we wouldn't stay on the side of the road, And he said, no, it wouldn't be safe. And I said, well, you'd be perfectly safe at Sealy Lake, and if the natives come along, they'd probably help you. They won't do anything to you. But, yes, it was rather amusing. And the person that came in and wanted 2 bedrooms and a nice motel with a swimming pool. I said, the only thing I can send you down to Lake Catherine, there's some rustic cabins down there. But she didn't know. She settled for what I think was a Taib. It was a very nice hotel. Mm-hmm. And sent them there.